debate who, what's the word?
Made the effort,
but were willing to. To brave the weather, that's what I wanted to say. Have you seen the drizzles outside? Okay, so indeed it's a wonderful opportunity and a great honor for us to have our good state all the way from Israel. And just announce it, must thank the Israeli congregation of Cape Town, Rav Ben Shlush, who's organized his trip here. He spent Shabbat. Rav Grunstein has spoken in a number of other congregations. We took the opportunity to have him come and speak to us. And when he sent me the list of topics, I thought this was something that is on people's mind. It's contemporary. And what does Torah have to say about it? As we quoted in the little blurb, as we refer to global warming, as we refer to as perhaps the most urgent threat facing our world. And it certainly begs a response. How do we understand what is our responsibility towards this? Rav Grunstein is an expert in Jewish law and Jewish thought. He's a rabbi's rabbi in the sense that he trains rabbis to be rabbis. That's your full-time, his main occupation at the moment, is running an institute that trains rabbis and supports them as they're sent out into the world. In fact, we had an opportunity to interview somebody this past week that has been studying with Princeton, and the exciting things that he's got happening for Cape Town. He's also been a congregational rabbi, so he'll be familiar with people of our ilk over here, and is involved in basically the overseas conversions in the land of Israel, so obviously has expertise in taking basic ideas of Yiddishkeit to making sure that it's incorporated into people's lives. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Rav Yehoshua Grunstein, and we look forward to your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Rabbi Hecht, and thank you for that warm introduction on this cold evening. I didn't know that Cape Town had cold weather till today, and that was a wonderful surprise. Actually, when you go jogging on the beach, it's a better surprise than you think. And I thank you for the warm introduction, some of which was true, some of which is what to aspire to. So I come out of this evening thinking of many things to aspire to, such as being an expert on Jewish law. I have not gotten there as of yet. I hope that I'm trying to. But this particular issue, like many of the lectures I give, comes out of a personal experience, and I'll explain what happens. When I give a lecture, I believe that's the Jewish response to various things that happen in life, usually things that get on your nerves. Namely, when you're standing online and you're very upset that, oh my gosh, it's taking such a long time, that's a topic for a lecture. Patience. Same thing here. How did I get to global warming? I got to global warming with the story on the top of the source sheet. You can read the story, I'll paraphrase it. I was a rabbi, as Rabbi Hecht said, in a place called Halifax, Nova Scotia. Don't try to think where it is, most people don't have no idea. It's somewhere in the world. Take my word for it. I got there, I was about 2 weeks into my position, and they told me that on this particular day, you take your garbage from where it is in your house, you put it on the curb, and the garbage truck comes, and it takes it. Garbage in English, where I come from, means rubbish, I believe, in South Africa. If any other English word I say you don't understand, please, I'll translate. So you take the rubbish bin from here to there. So we come to our new home and we see three rubbish bins. One is green, one is gray, and one is blue. And we think, okay, we have three rubbish bins. This is wonderful. And we just throw it all in there. The day comes. I go to shul in the morning, like a Jew usually does. I come home. There's a sticker on the three rubbish bins. Your rubbish was rejected. In my life, I didn't think that there would ever be a situation where my garbage wouldn't be good enough for other people. And thus, I wrote the article on the top of the page called "Your Garbage is Not Good Enough for Halifax." Because I had no idea in the year 2003 when I arrived there, that there's something called global warming, and because of which there's something called recycling, and then all the categories you see on the page, such as bottles, cans, plastic, compost, paper, newspapers, cartons, all of which you had to separate, actually existed. In my mind, being a New York-born Jew, as you can probably discern from my accent, going to Israel at the age of 11, all of the categories in the second source on the page is called garbage. If I want to show off my English, I'll say rubbish. I did not know that there were categories. And so, from that day on, all of a sudden, so my garbage would not be rejected, and my garbage would be good enough for the authorities who collect it in Halifax, I had around 6 different bins within the house. One for compost, that is for leftovers of food and whatnot. The second for cans, the third for plastic, the fourth for newspapers, the fifth for cartons, and I already forget what was the sixth. But the bottom line was, there was like a whole room devoted just to this. Little room, that's what it's for. And the question I have this evening is that if there indeed is a problem of global warming, and in order to fight it, we have to recycle. Is this a Jewish obligation? And if so, what is the nature of that obligation? Or to be more precise, if it's a Jewish obligation, what can we discern from it to ourselves? Because like any mitzvah in the Torah, as I wrote in my new book, Beyond Routine, I believe that anything you go through will influence you. If ultimately you were in a plane that almost crashed and it didn't, it influences you. Some people need therapy afterwards, and some people can laugh it off, but it does influence you. If, God forbid, you fell down and you broke your leg and you got healed, there will always be a scar there somewhere or another on your bone. They will always know that you did it. Now, how do I know that? I'm not a doctor, and I'm not an expert on global warming. I'll tell you how I know that. I once did an x-ray. And the doctor, who was the x-ray specialist, looked at the x-ray and said, "You sprained your ankle." I said, "You're right. 20 years ago. How did you know that?" He said, "Here, there it is." So if we go through this experience of recycling and fighting global warming, what do we take home with us? How does it influence us to be better people and to be better Jews? If we shook the lulav, it's supposed to influence us. If we heard the shofar, it's supposed to influence us. So if recycling is a Jewish obligation, how does recycling influence us? And I would like this evening to say it influences us in 2 different ways. Number one has nothing to do with Judaism. If you look on your source sheet, my Rebbe and mentor, Rav Yehuda Amital, may he rest in peace, had a saying. We say it every morning in davening, and he said it a little differently. It just depends on where you put the apostrophe. Every morning in davening we say, "Lo'olam yeyeh hadam yirei shamayim." A person should always be a God-fearing person. He would say that in Europe they used to say, "Lo'olam yeyeh hadam." A person should be a mensch, a human being, apostrophe, then yirei shamayim, God-fearing. Namely, first we're a mensch, we're a human being, we're part of the human race, and we have to be upright human beings. And secondly, the second floor is we have to be Jews. In other words, when we eat kosher food, first and foremost, we're eating like every human being eats. Everyone likes to eat and drink. I know Jews like to eat and drink more than the typical human being, but we all like to eat and drink. So when we eat and drink, first and foremost, it's what everyone does. And secondly, we do it in a different fashion. As Jews, we say a bracha before and after. We only eat kosher food and whatnot. The same thing, I believe, is true with regard to this topic this evening. Global warming has to be taken into consideration from both the general universal aspect and the more particular Jewish one. So let's start with the general one. If I didn't know any Jewish law, would I be obligated to recycle?
Yes.
Why?
It's Derech Eretz.
It's Derech Eretz. It sounds like a good idea. Why not? Why not? Someone says jogging prevents heart disease. Sounds like a good idea. Let's take up jogging. And the truth of the matter is, this is buttressed within the sources we have, within the Gemara and many other sources. If you look on your source sheet, you'll see in Masechet Eruvin, page 100b, it says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, said Rabbi Yochanan, Im alei lo nitna Torah, if the Torah was never given at Mount Sinai, picture the scene. You would never have blintzes on Shavuos. Torah was never given. Says the Gemara, Hayinu limedim tzniut michatu. You would learn the laws of modesty from a cat, the gezel minimala, and you would learn the laws of not stealing from an ant, va'ayarot miyonah derecheretz mitarnagol, and the Gemara goes on. Namely, according to this Gemara, even if Jewish law was never given to the Jewish people, certain elements of being an upright individual, such as being modest, not stealing, and the list goes on, we would learn from society. And in this case, they say you would learn it from various animals. So if the Torah didn't say to be modest, we would still learn it from, as the Gemara says, the cat. If you look at the next source from a Medrash, the Medrash says, Ism et mishpatai ta'asu, I'm going over to the English, you shall keep my laws. Those laws written in the Torah, which had they not been written, it would have been proper to write them. For example, theft, forbidden relationships, idolatry, blasphemy, and murder. In other words, if a Jew wakes up in the morning and you say to him, why can't you murder your neighbor? And the only answer he says is because in the Ten Commandments it says not to murder, that's an incomplete answer. First and foremost, murder is a bad thing. Secondly, it also says it in the Ten Commandments. If you go to someone and you say, can you steal? And their only answer is, oh, I would have stole everything. I would have stole people's money. I would have stolen their cars. But, oh my gosh, the Ten Commandments says no, can't do it. Says these two sources, there's certain elements of being a human being that you don't need the Torah for. Yes, the Torah added something to it, but quite frankly, even without the Torah, you would have done it. So I don't think anyone in this room in their right mind on the month of September, October, would have said, you know what the right thing to do now is? Oh, what's that? To be in shul for 25 hours, to fast, to daven, and to pretend we're angels. Would you come up with that on your own? Well, I'll give you another one. Let's pretend that we're next year. Next year is a leap year. So Sukkot is going to be around this time of the year. Let's pretend tonight's the night of Sukkot. And let's pretend it's exactly the same weather that the rabbi alluded to when we began. It's drizzling outside. Would anyone here in their right mind say, you know what a human being should do tonight? No, what's that? We should all go outside and sit outside. Hey, well, we'll get wet. No, it's the right thing to do. No one in their right mind would keep Yom Kippur, or Sukkot, or Rosh Hashanah, or Pesach, or Shavuos, let alone the laws of Shabbos, without the Torah telling us. However, people in their right mind would not steal, would be modest, would not murder, even without the Torah. And that's what the Gemara in Eruvin and the Medrash in Torat Kohanim says. As the Chizkuni says, and this is already a step further, he asks the following question about what we read about a few weeks ago. We're now in Parshat Chayei Sarah. If you go back a few weeks, we're in Parshat Noach. Everybody here knows what Parshat Noach is about, right? Okay, my questions are not theoretical. They're actual questions. What was Parshat Noach about?
Building a boat
because of rain, not just rain. This is not Rabbi Hecht's drizzle over here. This was the world's going to be destroyed. Ask the Chizkuni, one of the interpreters on the Bible, the following question: what right did God have to come to the world and say you have to be destroyed, you terrible people? Did God ever tell the world not to do terrible things? After all, the Torah was given thousands of years later, hundreds of years later. So why did God destroy the world? You can go up to someone and you say, it's forbidden to steal. And if you steal, you'll be put in jail. If they steal, you put them in jail. But if you never told them you're not allowed to steal, what right do you have to put them in jail? Ask the Chizkuni v'im tomar. Ech nen shudor ha-mabu me'achar shelo nitztavu al ha-mitzvot. How come God went ahead and destroyed the world? After all, He never told the people of the world, don't steal, don't do this, don't do that. All the terrible acts, quote unquote, that they did before God destroyed the world in that big flood, God never said not to do. So what right did God have to punish them? Esther the Chizkuni, v'yesh lomar, and I'm going over to the English now. It may be suggested that there are certain commandments that people are obligated to observe by force of reason, even if they were never commanded, and therefore they were punished. Namely, God would never punish the Jewish people for not keeping Yom Kippur if he never commanded us to keep Yom Kippur. But yes, God would punish the human race for stealing and for murdering, even if he didn't command them, because it goes with common sense. So the first point I wanted to make this evening is that even if we can't even find a source for recycling, the very fact that it sounds like a good idea, the very fact that experts are suggesting it in order to prevent the results of global warming, we have to keep it. Because even if the Torah doesn't say so, we will be held liable for good ideas, for right ideas, even if the Torah didn't command us. There was a question in the back. I'm sorry.
Well, I've never heard that connotation that God didn't tell the people that you know they were doing wrong. But I mean, you know, he's omnipotent and he can do whatever he wants. They didn't need him, but he saw it.
But again, God in the Torah says that because they were doing what's called chamas, namely bad acts in the name of God, in the eyes of God, therefore he's going ahead and punishing them and bringing and destroying the world. So the Chizkuni said, how do you know they were bad? Maybe they were good. And the answer is common sense. So first and foremost, I believe that as Jews, we have to be lo olam yehei adam. We have to be human beings, and human beings recycle to prevent the results of global warming. I believe we, as Jews, should do the same thing like the rest of the human race will do. And as you can see here, it's buttressed in many, many different sources. If you want to read the introduction of Rav Nissim Gaon to the entire Talmud, he makes exactly the same point. If you turn the page, however, now that we said it's a general good idea, let's see if there's a Jewish obligation. And I'd like this evening to share with you one of the many obligations that I could think of why we as Jews have to prevent global warming. And I can think of many, but I'm going to go to tonight and talk about just one. And that's the following. We have something in the Torah that our mothers, our teachers, usually said every time we didn't finish our plate. Do you remember what they said? I never heard that, but that's interesting. What did our mothers and our teachers say when we took a good half a sandwich and threw it in the rubbish bin? What did they say when we didn't finish our plate? They said they're wasting your food. If they were a bit more Jewish, they would use the Jewish term called Baal Tashchit. Oh my gosh, the minute they say Baal Tashchit, you are liable for a biblical prohibition of ruining something. Now, where does that come from? So like most things in life, when you're a kid, you believe, okay, I'm doing a terrible thing. And when you grow up, you find out maybe it's not so. For example, I was told as a kid it's a mitzvah to kiss the mezuzah. I am still looking, I'm 41 years old, for the mitzvah to kiss a mezuzah. I have not found it as of yet. There is a mitzvah to put up a mezuzah. There is a mitzvah to maintain a mezuzah. There is no mitzvah I know of to kiss the mezuzah. Yes, it's beautiful. I have nothing against it. But there's no mitzvah to kiss the mezuzah. But as a kid, they tell you, kiss the mezuzah. You think everything's a mitzvah. So let's think, if I take my half a sandwich and I throw it in the rubbish bin, is that Baal Tashchit? Am I violating what it says in the top of page 2, where it says explicitly that you're not allowed to cut down fruit trees during a siege on a city? And if you do, you're violating the prohibition of called Baal Tashchit. As the Pasuk says, top of the second page on the right, Lo tashchit et eitza lindor chalav garzein, when you place a siege on the city, do not destroy the trees. Thus the saying Baal Tashchit. You had a comment?
This thing about kissing the mezuzah, you've got the tefillin, and there's a similar sort of parchment in the tefillin as the mezuzah. So if you're kissing the tefillin, which it says in the Torah, you're supposed to, with the tzitzit, kiss the tefillin and touch it with your hand. So you might even do the same with the mezuzah. It doesn't tell you that, but it's common sense.
Well, when it comes to tefillin, your name again? Philip, it does say in the Gemara that you should touch your tefillin when you allude to it in the Shema in the morning. Absolutely. It doesn't say that with regard to the mezuzah. All it says about the mezuzah is you have to put it on your doorpost. But the Gemara does say that when you have your tefillin on, in order to show that you're fulfilling what God said, then indeed you shall say, when it says in the Torah, and I say the words, and you shall tie the tefillin on your arm, touch the tefillin. So theoretically, according to that common sense, Philip would say, well, if you happen to be saying Shema, and you happen to be walking through the door, and you happen to get to the pasuk that says that you should put a mezuzah up, it would probably be a good idea to kiss the mezuzah. The probability of that happening, however, Philip, is rather low, because we usually don't say Shema as we're walking through the door. But we do say Shema when we have to fill it on. Getting back to our story, after that beautiful commercial break, which is a beautiful comment from Philip, because I never thought of it before. Quite frankly, the Torah says that when you have a siege on the city, you don't destroy its fruit trees, because there's no reason to destroy things that are good. So if there's a fruit tree, and you can use it for something, and all you do is destroy it, you are violating a prohibition called Baal Tashchit, destroying something. And I brought the exact way that our sages learned this from this word, from this verse. They say, you shall eat from the tree is a positive commandment, and you shall not cut them down is a negative commandment. Then it should be, if indeed they besiege you, it is the way of your creating a siege, then you can cut it down. In other words, if you need the tree to be out of the way in order to make the siege, you can cut it down. If not, trees that have no function, you can cut down. Trees with fruit, no, because when you destroy a tree with fruit, you're destroying something for no reason. That's the main prohibition in the Torah called Baal Tashchit. Every time the Torah gives you an example of anything, we have to ask a fundamental question. Is the example limited to that example, or is it just an example? Namely, if the Torah says, don't steal a watch, for example. It doesn't say that, but let's just assume it did. Does that mean only a watch, but I'm allowed to steal your money? Or a watch is a mere example of everything that's owned by another person that you're not allowed to steal. So here, the example are fruit trees. Is it limited to fruit trees, or is it everything? If you look on your source sheet, you'll see this is a fundamental difference of opinion between the Tosfot and the Rambam. The Tosfot on the right side of the page says as follows. Says the Tosfot, if indeed you're not allowed to destroy anything, not just fruit trees, how come you're allowed to, when a king dies, take its clothes, the king's clothes, and burn them? After all, if the king's dead, take his clothes and let someone else wear them. How come you're allowed to do that? And the Tosfot answers, well, it shows honor to the king, that this king is gone, and he's no longer going to wear his kingly clothes, and therefore you burn the clothes because it's his honor. Namely, what does the Tosfot say? Is it limited or not limited to trees?
It is limited.
Why?
Because trees is no reason to burn the
interesting. If you look on Amitai again, he doesn't say that. Look at his words. Vishum de kvod melech ben asi adiv kemo bal tashchit de nitcha mipnei kvodam. What does that mean? There is a prohibition of bal tashchit. You cannot burn clothing, rip clothing. You cannot just ruin something for kicks. You can't go into your hotel room and say, well, I don't own this room, so right before I'll check out, I'll break the chair. You can't do that. When are you allowed to do that? In a certain circumstance when there is a mitigating factor that allows you to do it. In this case, the honor of the king. But if not, the three R's, reduce, reuse, and anyone?
Recycle?
Biblical. Unless you have a mitigating factor. The Rambam comes along and disagrees. The Rambam, when he codifies Jewish law, talks about exactly this situation of trees and says it's not just in a siege. Lo b'matzor bilval, lo b'chol makom kol hakotzetz ilan ma'achal derech hashchata lokeh. So let's assume it was a Sunday afternoon like we had this week. It wasn't cold. It was beautiful outside. Your kids or your grandchildren are at home and you say, let's do something fun. You take an axe, you go out to the woods, and you just cut down a fruit tree. Why? Because it's Sunday, we have to pass the time. Let's just do it. For what? For kicks. Are you allowed to do that? Says the Rambam, absolutely forbidden biblically. But he goes on to say that the following words, V'lo ha'ilanot bilvad, and not only the trees, Ela kol ha'mishaber kelim v'koreh b'gadim, anyone that breaks chairs, for example, or rips clothing for no reason, U'me'abed ma'chalot derech hashchata, and throws out good food in a way that it destroys it and ruins it, Over b'lo tashchit, but it's not biblical. Ve'eino lokeh lo makat mardut midivrehem. It's rabbinic. So according to the Tosfot, any time you ruin anything, from trees to chairs, it's biblical. Unless you have a reason to do it. According to the Rambam, trees, fruit trees, biblical. Chairs, clothing, and all the rest, rabbinic. Fundamental difference of opinion. So just reiterate, we said that we would recycle because it's a good idea, regardless of the Jewish aspect. But if we go into the Jewish aspect, we have one prototype in the Torah of ruining something. Namely, instead of putting it into the recycle bin, we put it into the regular rubbish bin, and that is cutting down fruit trees. Is it limited to that or not? Says the Tosfot, it's not. It's biblical to ruin anything. And the Rambam says, it's rabbinically forbidden to ruin anything. Only fruit trees are biblical. Now, why is that so important to us? We're good Jews. We keep the rabbinic commandments and the biblical commandments. We fasted on Yom Kippur and we get drunk on Purim. One is biblical, one's rabbinic. Right? We're very, very careful about the drunk on Purim as well as fasting on Yom Kippur. Correct? So, why does it make a difference to us? Let's see if it makes a difference to us. Yeah?
Because fruit is given by God. It's one of the supplements. And why should one get rid of it? I mean,
Could be that fruit trees were something sort of natural made by God versus everything else which is made by human beings, such as chairs and clothing. Could be. That's why the Rambam says they're different. I'm going to suggest something a bit differently this evening, and we'll see. The Gemara says in Bava Kama as follows. Amar Rabbi Elazar, says Rabbi Elazar, Shamati, I heard, Shamekarea lamed yoter midai lokeh mishum baal tashchit. As you know, God forbid if there's a funeral, I'm sure you've seen it, the seven relatives of the deceased have to rip their clothes, rip their shirt. Now, that's a law. They have to do it. Let's say instead of just ripping a little bit, you rip the whole shirt. Says the Gemara in Bava Kama, you have violated the law of thou shall not destroy. Baal tashchit. Once again, the Gemara says, Va'atnan, what we learn, me'ematayen kotzitzinite ilanot bashvi'it, from when are you not allowed to cut down trees in the seventh Shemitah year? The seventh Shemitah year in Israel is a holy year. All the trees are holy. They're all keeping Shabbos all year. In other words, they're unemployed all year. You're supposed to keep them unemployed. We only do it once a week. That's a whole year for them. They get a better deal. Now, that year, what is the time you're not allowed to destroy those trees because of the laws of Shemitah? Tosfos says, V'im tomar v'lo shvi'it nami teful klei dasur mishum lo tashchit et eitza. Ask the Tosfos, why is the Gemara so concerned about from what time you're not allowed to cut down a tree on the seventh year? Every year, year one, year two, year three, year four, you're not allowed to cut down trees. Why? It's destroying trees. You're not allowed to destroy trees any of the years. We just learned that. It's an absolute open verse in the Torah. So how come the Gemara is so concerned about the seventh year? After all, it's not just the seventh year. It's every year. It was like someone told me. He got to a certain community in 1932, and there were two Shomer Shabbos Jews there. That's it. Two Shabbos observant Jews. And then he added, but there were many Sabbath observant Jews above the age of 70. So I said, I don't understand what you just said. You said there were two, then you say there was a lot. No, the people under 70, there were only two. They didn't work on Shabbos, but they worked 6 days of the week. The people above 70 were Shomer Shabbos, they were Shomer Sunday, they were Shomer Monday. Why? Because they were retired, they had nothing better to do, so they never worked. So ultimately, says the Tosfot, exactly that question. Why are you so concerned about the seventh year? In year one and year two, you're not allowed to cut down trees. Gives the Tosfos two answers. Number one, V'yesh lomar, and you can say, the tree didn't bear fruit yet in a measure of a cob, and therefore you're allowed to cut it down. That's answer number one. Answer number two, we're speaking of a case that you can make more money by making wood out of them, in which case there's no prohibition of Baal Tashchit. The Tosfos gives two answers. The first answer is that the tree is not a fruit tree as of yet. It's a small little tree. It doesn't have the status of a fruit tree as of yet. So therefore the prohibition didn't kick in, and thus the Gemara is only concerned about the laws of Shemitah. The second answer says, no, actually it's a big, nice, beautiful tree. It's giving oranges all the time. However, you're allowed to cut down a tree if you can make wood out of it. Now, when we deal with biblical prohibitions, 1 second, Shabtai, then we don't start saying you're allowed to override biblical prohibitions because of mitigating factors. There's one mitigating factor that overrides a biblical prohibition. You know what that is? Pikuach nefesh. If you're about to drop dead, then, and only then you start playing, saying no. So if a person has to fast on Yom Kippur biblically, the only way the person does not have to fast on Yom Kippur will be what? If it's pikuach nefesh, if his life is in danger. Simple. That's a law. You don't need to be a rocket scientist. Now, let's take another fast day. Ta'anit Esther. Ta'anit Esther is a custom. Let's take another fast day. Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is a rabbinic fast day. Who doesn't have to fast on Tisha B'Av? Well, once it's rabbinic, all of a sudden the floodgates open. And we have various factors. Obviously, pikuach nefesh is in there, life endangering. Plus, chole she'ein bo sakana, a person who's sick in bed, too sick to go to work, which divides between men and women. Women can be sick, and they're still mothers, and they're still wives, but they're very, very sick. They should be in bed, but they're not. Men, they have a sniffle. Oh, I'm so sick, I gotta go to sleep. Oh my gosh, I can't go to work. Quite frankly, Tisha B'Av, because it's rabbinic, more leeway. Ta'anit Esther, a custom, even more leeway. The minute the Tosfos says, no, you can cut down a tree to make wood, that sounds a little rabbinic. The minute the Tosfos, on the other hand, says, it's not a fruit tree, but if it was, you couldn't touch it, that sounds very biblical. Now, why is it so important to us to know if it's biblical or rabbinic? If you turn the page, I would like to suggest as follows, and then I'll take Shabtai's question. In my humble opinion, when it comes to this prohibition of ruining things, there's two ways to understand it. The first way is the Ramban on the left side. The Ramban basically says very beautifully, we are commanded when setting a siege to eat from the trees in its vicinity during the entirety of the siege. And if you cut it down in a destructive way, you'd violate the positive commandment beyond the negative prohibition, clearly delineated, and this is what God stated, for you shall eat from them and you shall not cut them down. In other words, what the Ramban Nachmanides is saying is, you're supposed to enjoy what you can, benefit from it if you can, but if you can't, you can't. So if you're in front of a city and you're laying a siege and there's delicious fruit on the trees, gain benefit from it. Why not? That's what God gave it to you for. As the Natsi from Volozhin many years later says, and I quote, "Kol ma shenitzrach lahana'at ha'adam, mitzvah shelo la'ashchit elo lehenot mimeno." Anything that God gave us in order to have benefit from, we're supposed to derive benefit and not destroy. So if God gave us a fruit tree, you're supposed to enjoy it. We're not supposed to say, we don't need it, we're going to cut it down. That's the Ramban's perspective. Comes along the Sefer HaChinuch, and when he tries to knock sense into this law, he says something totally different. What does he say? He says that the reason that God said not to cut down fruit trees, and again, it's the Sefer HaChinuch's perspective, because we don't know why God said it. We weren't there. In other words, when people ask me, how come the Torah says you have to fast on Yom Kippur, my immediate automatic answer was, and is, I wasn't on the editorial board of the Torah. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why God said to rest on Saturday and not on Friday. I don't know why God said to celebrate Sukkot and Pesach. I wasn't there. God didn't consult with me. But after saying that, if I want to knock some sense into it, for me, a human being, says the Sefer HaChinuch, that this mitzvah is narchik mikol davar ra, mikol davar hashchata. That we should talk it into ourselves, not to ruin things. Not to ruin things at all. As Rashi says, that ultimately, you're not allowed to take food that's befit of a human being and give it to an animal, says Rashi, Mishum bizui ochalin, umechse keboet betovashi, shbia kodesh baruchu ba'olam. You can't take food befit of a human being, give it to an animal, because, quite frankly, you're starting to think, I can destroy things as much as I'd like. So according to the Ramban, if it's something you can derive benefit from, you should. And if you can't derive benefit from, destroy it, get rid of it. According to the Sefer HaChinuch, on the other hand, we have to talk it into ourselves to become people that don't destroy things. And only as a last resort, when there's no choice, we can destroy things. In my humble opinion, that's the difference of opinion, if it's biblical or rabbinic. If it's biblical, it's because destroying is a bad thing. God wants us to stay away from that trait of destroying. If it's rabbinic to destroy a chair, then basically what we're saying is, you're only not allowed to destroy something that you can derive benefit from. But if the chair is already half broken, throw it out. Don't try to fix it. That's what I believe the difference of opinion is based on. And if I'm right, in a moment, we'll see some ramifications. Shapta, you had a question. I'm sorry.
Tosfot, in his first answer, says that because he didn't give a cup of fruit, then it's not a fruit tree yet.
Right.
If we go according to Tosfot, everything is either rabbinical or a doi, then we can't, even if it doesn't happen, even if it's not a fruit tree, it would be not allowed. Like any tree is not allowed to destroy, doesn't matter if it's fruit.
That's as long as it's already a tree. Until it has the definition of a tree, the...
If it's not a tree, it's going to be, like, how is that not destroying? Like, if I can't throw a sandwich, why can't I destroy an apple tree? Or why can't I...
Because Tosfot said that it's not even a sandwich. It's not even a chair. It's not a bed. It's nothing. All it is a bush coming out of the ground.
Can't destroy a bush.
What?
Can't destroy a bush.
Right, says the Tosfot, yes. You can't destroy things that you can actually use. What are you going to do with this little log? That's what the first answer of Tosfot is. Yes. So basically, to sum up, we originally said that we should recycle because that's what the experts say to do. And even if we weren't Jewish, we would do it because we're part of humanity and it sounds like a good idea. And all it does is make us have a few more bins at home. Namely, instead of having one bin where you throw it all out, you have three bins. And if you live in Halifax, six. Wait a minute. Seven. I forgot one. Tell you which one at the end of the class. This was a big question. I asked the experts, they didn't know where to put this one. When it came to recycling, so once I knew there was a law, so, you know, a rabbi learned Talmud for a few years, he starts Talmudic, making a Talmudic class over recycling. So they tell you to recycle. So they say compost over here, plastic separate, cans separate, paper is different than cartons, and that's fine. What's between paper and cartons?
Glass.
Glass is another one. Very good. We have paper, we have cartons, we have glass, we have plastic, we have metal. What's left?
Newspapers.
There was a seventh category. Newspapers have to be packed in a certain way. So I asked the experts, aren't newspapers subsumed under the category of cartons or paper? They said, no, it's different. I said, why? It sounds like paper. It smells like paper. It's paper. It's just a newspaper versus a piece of paper. I said to them in a very nice way, a piece of paper is what I write on. Let's say I write a love note to my wife. A newspaper is usually bad news. That's the only difference between them. This is good news. This is bad news. Now, why is it that they're separate? I'm still waiting for an answer, Rabbi Hecht. I asked the experts, I got no answer. That we're going to take it to the experts. I have letters to this day attesting to what I'm saying. I'm still waiting for an answer.
Maybe they're also
it could be. But beyond the actual global human thing to recycle and to keep the environment healthy, we said there is a mitzvah in the Torah called do not destroy. And the question is it only limited to trees with everything else being rabbinic? Or is it everything being biblical? And I would like to suggest that it depends how you look at this particular prohibition. If it's to talk it into ourselves, don't ruin things. Reuse things. If you can't use it as a chair, use it as firewood. If you can't use it as a bed anymore, then take the mattress, use it as an extra mattress when the grandchildren come and sleep over. Then everything would be subsumed. Don't destroy. But if it's just trees with everything else being rabbinic, then I would say, whatever I can derive benefit from, I will. And whatever I can't derive benefit from, I won't. So for example, I have a cell phone. The battery's dead. Totally dead. The plug that plugs into the wall that makes it recharge is dead. I would throw it out. I can't derive benefit from it. But if I go according to the first point of view, no, don't destroy things, I'd look at the cell phone and I'd say, what can I do with this now? Let's think. A cell phone I can't use it for. A door stopper. I'm going to use it as a door stopper. So when the wind comes, this will be my door stopper. That's what I believe is the difference of opinion. Any questions up until now? Yes. You can absolutely cut it according to all points of view because you're using it. It's just like you're allowed to destroy, quote unquote, burn the king's clothing in order to show respect for the king. So too with your example of clothing, you're not destroying it. You're cutting it to size to reuse it again. That would be perfect. That would be perfect. The ramification would be when it's too small, do you throw it out? Or do you give it to places that collect clothing for people that are that size? In my case, it's the opposite. I'm gaining weight, so it's not too small. It's too small indeed. So I have to think to myself, what am I going to do with it? Yes, Philip, and then we'll hear from you.
Is it that I feel that I can give it to charity? It's not to charity. The prohibition of the king's clothes, you said it was to burn it. So what do you do with this money?
Which money?
The money of the king.
Good question. The money of the king is usually inherited by the next king that comes after him, usually his son, if he has a son. Yes?
What about downgrading? You've got a pot, which is very useful. You nourish a lot of people with that pot. Then you want to use it as a doorstop. Is that destruction? Or is that downgrading? Or is it forbidden?
Exactly this ramification. In other words, if indeed everything is biblical, then you would say, okay, let's reuse everything until you can't reuse it no more. Namely, until there's no way to reuse it, you have to continue to reuse it, whatever it could be. But if it's rabbinic, you have more of a leeway. So I can't use it as a pot because it got burnt on the bottom. Usually that happens when a man cooks in the kitchen. It gets so burnt on the bottom, there's no way that you're ever going to get it out. And all the food is sticking to it. There's no way you can use it as a pot anymore. Goodbye, pot. Now, if it's a biblical prohibition to ruin things, I would say, oh, what can I use this pot for? Let's think. You know what? I'll store my screws and nails in it. But if you say no, it's not a rabbinic, a biblical prohibition, but rabbinic. Then once I can't use it, goodbye. In other words, do we have to go out of our way not to destroy things? Or do we only have to go out of our way not to destroy things that are functional for us, but once they're not functional, goodbye? For example, I'm looking at your coffee machine on my left. A beautiful coffee machine. Is that a coffee machine? Thank God. Now let's assume that coffee machine stops working as a coffee machine, but it still produces hot water. That would be a ramification for what I said. The rabbi of the synagogue would get the question, and he'd have to decide who's correct. If it's biblical, well, it still produces hot water, so let's use it for tea. If it's rabbinic, we'll say, listen, for hot water we have an urn. We don't need that. That's a fancy machine for coffee. The minute it doesn't work as a coffee machine, out the door it goes. In other words, do we as Jews have to talk it into ourselves never to destroy things, always to reuse things, or only when it's functional for that thing, we reuse it? Once it's finished, it's finished. When I was a kid, growing up in Israel, maybe Shabtai remembers this when he was a kid, but he's a bit younger than me. When I was a kid growing up in Israel, my parents told me everything in Israel is expensive. When I grew up, I'm married, I have four children, guess what? They're right. Everything in Israel is expensive. So because everything in Israel is expensive, and this is just not just my parents, but many parents, when you went into homes, you found cups of different kinds of cups. You had cups like this. These look like cups. You have cups that were glass. You had cups that were plastic. And then, this is my favorite. You ready for this? You had former yogurt things. What do you call the yogurt thing? They became a cup. The ice cream tub became the Tupperware that you store the leftovers in. And the list goes on and on and on. You remember this, Shabtai? Am I talking ancient history? Yes. See, the difference between me and Shabtai is we live in the same neighborhood, but he still has hair. I don't have hair. So therefore, I'm not sure. This is like, no.
Current affairs.
Okay. So ultimately, everything is reused. Everything is reused. Including the ice, no more ice cream, we'll use it to store food. You can't use it for yogurt because you ate the yogurt, use it as a cup.
Maybe the seven
friends on the Sabbath. Maybe the seven friends on the Sabbath, they recycle, you still do it.
My eyes saw, I was in a room and I saw an iron, you know, a hot iron that you use to iron clothing when they get wrinkled in the wash. Okay, it was so burnt, I said, anytime you put a white shirt under it, there goes the white shirt. So I said this to these bachurim, these shlichim, that said that we, of course, we know that. We're not dumb. We don't use it as an iron. I said, so what do you use it as? When we want to have grilled cheese, that's what we use it. They were very stringent. I'm not kidding. That's the way they make toast. Why buy a toaster? You have an iron. One side, other side, finished. It was the first time in my life I saw a milichik iron. A dairy. I thought it was a joke. A dairy iron? I saw a dairy iron. Absolutely dairy. Yes, question. Two?
Hoarding
food. Excellent example.
Hoarding stuff.
Hoarding stuff and hoarding food. A kiddush at a shul is a very good example of what we're saying. A kiddush at a shul, what usually happens is as follows. You tell me if your shul is different. This has been my experience in the world. Davening is too long in any shul you go to on Shabbos. Finished. Sephardi, Ashkenazi, Temani, it's too long. Whatever way you cut it. It can be an hour, it's still too long. After davening, people are starved. How do I know people are starved? Because if there's a bar mitzvah, or there's an afruf, and they throw candies, the kids run after those candies as if they didn't eat in a week. Shuls, the minute you come through the threshold of the door, people have die of starvation. They're starving. Comes the kiddush. They're very disciplined human beings. They wait for the rabbi to make kiddush. The minute they hear the words, "Borei pri agafen," boom, they go for the food. They're starving. They fill up their plates. What usually happens? As Philip mentioned, they hoard food. They don't finish their plates. Is that a prohibition of Baal Tashchit on a level of the Torah, namely biblical, or on a rabbinic level? Is exactly our difference of opinion. Exactly our difference of opinion. By the way, any way you cut it, it is prohibited. You shouldn't hoard food. It's ruining food. It might be biblical, it might be rabbinic, but quite frankly, you shouldn't hoard food. Either because it's not right to ruin food in general, or because other people can eat from it. Why are you hoarding so much cholent if you're not going to eat all that cholent? Now, yes?
Because people hoard things that don't throw them away. So you come, your house is full of stuff and you're a hoarder.
Oh, now I understand your question. So Philip is bringing, in my opinion, a novel ramification to what I said. He says, if you have a home, and every one of us have these kinds of homes. I moved 2 years ago almost, so I know what you mean. This Hanukkah will be 2 years. When I moved, the amount of stuff that was moved almost equaled the amount of stuff that was chucked. Either given away to charity or chucked to the... Now, says Philip, maybe the very fact that in your home you have, for example, 10 cups that you're not using, while there's poor people out there that could be using those cups, but they're in your china cabinet, they're just sitting there doing nothing, maybe you're going ahead and violating Jewish law. Because you're not ruining anything, albeit you're not using it. So if the prohibition is to ruin, I'm not ruining it, it's sitting there. I'm not doing a thing. I'm just not using it. But if the prohibition is to use and to benefit from this world, says Philip, you're preventing people from benefiting. You always use mug number one. Your wife used mug number two for coffee. You have 10 mugs in the cupboard. What are the other 8 doing there? Nothing. They're as useless as a tie. Does anyone ever think about why we wear ties? Thank God Rabbi Hecht has much more logic than me. He doesn't wear a tie. Have you ever thought of a more useless item than a tie? Let me ask you a question. If I came to you this evening and I said, I have an idea for a business. My idea for a business is, there you go, that's the chime. I'm going to take a shmata and I'm going to put it around the neck and we're going to sell it. And then you're going to ask a simple question. What does the shmata do? I'll say nothing. It just sits there like this all day. Would you invest in that business? So says Philip, if indeed you're right, Rabbi, then if the 8 mugs are sitting in the cupboard doing nothing, they're just sitting there, I'm not ruining anything. On the other hand, I'm not gaining benefit from it, and I'm not letting others benefit from it. Maybe it's a bad idea. So obviously Philip will agree that if you're going to have guests over, not every week, but once in a while, you need it. But if you don't have guests over, then what are they doing there? Give it away. You need one mug. Give the mugs away to other people. Interesting. Never thought of it. Could be a ramification. That's the opposite. You're not ruining anything. It's just sitting there, not being used. I would like to give another practical ramification for this particular difference of opinion. Yeah. Sheval in a sheval taseh fashion, absolutely. Do you violate in a sheval taseh? I have to think more about that, Philip, because I never thought of it until you brought it up. But let's think of something that's very common. We mentioned the Shabbos Kiddushes. Let's mention another byproduct of Shabbos. See, Shabbos, by the Jewish people, is a very, very important day because there's so many inner contradictions on Shabbos. For example, we have to eat 3 meals, but we're not allowed to cook them. Correct? They have to be warm, but you can't light a fire. Now here comes the best inner contradiction of the 21st century. You have to have at least 2 meals, perhaps the 3rd meal, a double challah, and you have to cut at least one of them and eat from it. Everyone knows that particular obligation of Shabbat. Very good. We're not used to eating so much bread. Many of us are on carb-free diets. That's not the way we eat today. By us, it's the opposite. We eat a sandwich when there's nothing to eat. We take a sandwich to work. We take a sandwich on a trip. We don't eat sandwiches at home. But once upon a time, this is the way Jews ate. Now, you come to Shabbos, you have a big challah, hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz. Everyone eats a piece. There's 10 pieces left at every meal. What do you do with those 10 pieces? Your name? So either you grill cheese them during the week, or you make French toast out of them. That was the custom when I was a kid. You make challah kugel. But even if you took care of your 10 pieces of challah at the end of the meal, when the guests left the house, and you cleaned up the dishes, and everything is taken off the table, what's left on the table, inevitably? Crumbs. Crumbs! What do you do with the crumbs? Are you allowed to destroy them or not? The simplest way to take care of crumbs, sweep them in the rubbish bin, bye. If you live in a place like Canada, you have to put in a compost bin. Got it. So you're not ruining anything. But if you live in normal places, such as places without compost, then, my dear friends, what do you do with the crumbs? Guess what? The Gemara deals with this. Brachot, daf nun bet. Beit Shammai omrim, mechabdim et habayit, v'achar kach notlim liyadayim, sh'im et ha'omer notlim liyadayim tchilan, mitzat ha'mafsid et ha'peo chalein. At the end of the meal, many have the custom. It could be, it's not a custom, it's a law, but today we basically have decided that it's a custom, that you wash not just before you eat bread, but after you eat bread. The first time you wash is called Mayim Rishonim. We all wash for bread. And the last time you wash, right before you bench, is called, take a wild guess, Mayim Achronim. All right? Says Beit Shammai, you better clean the table first, because if not, what's going to happen? You're going to start washing on the table. You're going to put the water on the crumbs, and you're ruining the crumbs. Comes along Beit Hillel and says, due respect, Ima shamash tamid chacham hu, notel peorin sheyesh bayim kezayit, uminich peorin shenken kezayit. Says Beit Hillel, due respect, no one's going to eat a crumb. A crumb is useless. What are they going to eat? a piece of bread. What's a minimum piece of bread? The minimum you need to make a bracha, no, excuse me, to make the birkat hamazon, the benching afterwards. The minimum, rabbinically, is a kezayit. The kezayit is an olive size. Picture a normative matchbox. That you can't wash on. But if all you have is little crumbs, no one's going to use crumbs. No one's going to get the crumbs together and make a crumb cake out of it. So quite frankly, says Beit Hillel, that's what we do. And that's basically what the Gemara says. Tosfos says that even though that's true, it's a good omen in order not to be poor to get all the crumbs off the table and take care of them. Now what is this difference of opinion based on? Do we need to be worried about the crumbs or not? Says the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, Kodim sheyitol yadavi chabed abayit shelo yisharu shum pirurin, af al pi shemutar la'abed pirurin shen mehem kezayit, shem yeh shama shama aretz. Af al pi shemutar la'abed pirurin shen mehem kezayit, b'chom hum kasheh la'aniyut. Says the Shulchan Aruch, that if indeed the person is smart and knows Jewish law, then before they'll wash on the table, they'll bring out that mayim achronim, you know, those things they sell in the Judaica stores to wash your hands, then they'll make sure there's no real bread on the table. But little crumbs is not a problem, though it's a bad omen to get poor. Comes along the Magen Avraham, which is an interpretation on the Jewish law, and says as follows, Tzarich Hiyun. Says the Magen Avraham, why is the Shulchan Aruch talking about this omen of becoming poor? Many omens are out there. That's not code of Jewish law. There's omens out there. It's a good idea to wear a red band around your wrist. So says people when you go to the Wailing Wall. Why? I don't know. It's an omen for something. Fine. Some people say it's a good omen right after Pesach to put a key in your challah. Why? It's a good thing to make a living. Now, the code of Jewish law would have said, to make a living, there's a good omen. You know what that is?
Work.
Go to work. Not a bad idea. I think most people would agree. That's what the code of Jewish law would say. He wouldn't bring the idea of, oh, make a key challah the Shabbos after Pesach. That's sort of like it would be in some book somewhere else, in some esoteric source. Says the Magen Avraham, why is he worried about it? Answers the Magen Avraham as follows. The only time you have a problem with the crumbs is when you see a crumb and you literally step on it. But if, by mistake, water spills on it, it's okay. Now let's think about this a second. If you go ahead and destroy it with your two feet or your two hands, that's destroying. We're supposed to talk it into ourselves not to destroy. But if by mistake you destroyed it by pouring water on it, that's okay because you're not out to destroy, you're out to wash the floor. It happens to be that while you were washing the floor, it went on to crumbs of bread. And that's what the Magen Avraham believes the Shulchan Aruch is saying. But if we take the Shulchan Aruch at face value, perhaps what he's saying is, anytime you ruin anything, no good. Even if it's a crumb. And it goes back to exactly what we said earlier. Is it terrible to destroy anything? Or is it only terrible to destroy things you can use? And destroy it in a destructive way. But if you're not destroying it in a destructive way, then it's okay. And this brings me to the last ramification on the page. You can look inside, and I read it outside. Let's say you want to cut down a tree, not to destroy the tree. You want to cut down the tree to use it as firewood. Or let's be a little more firm. Let's be a little more religious. You want to cut down the tree to use its branches for schach, for your sukkah. Oh, now we're talking Jewish. Can you do it?
Yes.
If you say destroying is destroying, it's destroying. I don't care. But if here you know, you're using it for a purpose. You're cutting down the tree to use it. Then it would probably be okay. But again, it goes back to this fundamental difference of opinion. Yeah, the real McCoy, that's its tree. In other words, according to the Rambam on the right side of the page, it says explicitly, etc. The Ramban Nachmanides says, namely, if you just ruin for the sake of ruining, no good. But if you're ruining the tree in order to reuse it for something else, it will be okay. So to make a long story short, we said this evening that we would recycle because that's what human beings do today, and it might be a good idea. And even if it doesn't help global warming, and again, I'm not an expert, I'd say, why not? Let's do it. If there's three bins, let's do it. But if you want to ask ourselves, is there a halachic obligation? There could very well be a halachic obligation. We're not allowed to ruin things. The question is, A, is it biblically just limited to trees and rabbinically goes to everything else? And B, if it does go to everything else, be it rabbinically or biblically, why? Because it's bad to destroy? Or because you can't use it for another purpose? But if you can use it for another purpose, then it's fine. And we brought various ramifications, and one of them is the crumbs left on the table, or destroying the tree in order to use it for walls for your sukkah or schach to cover your sukkah. So, in my humble opinion, as we come to this issue of global warming, I believe that we Jews have to be at the forefront of doing what we can to stop global warming. First of all, because we're part of humanity. And second of all, because there could be Jewish law involved. And here is where I would like to end with the following comment. I always find it very disturbing, as an observant Jew, that when it comes to issues that are global, it seems like the observant Jews are always in the back. They should be at the front. Because we have not just a general human obligation, many a times we have an additional Jewish obligation. And allow me to bring up a very relevant issue that's in the news right now as we speak. Vaccination of children. I don't know where this came from. I don't know why it came out, but someone said somewhere that it's against Jewish law to vaccinate your children. I don't know why they said that. Every rabbi I know, from the ultra-religious to the very light religious, all said you have to vaccinate your children. Now, if vaccination of children is something that a parent does, be it Jewish or non-Jewish, then in my humble opinion, the Jews should be at the forefront. Why? First of all, we're members of society. And secondly, we said it before, what's the one thing that overrides the Holy Sabbath, the Holy Yom Kippur, and everything else that's holy? Life. Life. So we should be at the forefront, not in the back, not online, in the forefront. Religious Jews should be the first people to say that we have to vaccinate children. And the same thing here. If there's a problem with global warming, and the way to fight it on a community level, on a personal level, is through recycling, we should be the first. First of all, because we're members of society, and second of all, because there's Jewish obligations or prohibitions involved. We have an additional obligation, not less of an obligation. It's very much like when people talk about modern orthodoxy. I don't know if you use that term here in South Africa. But many of people thought modern orthodoxy means that you're very modern and less orthodox, or very orthodox and less modern. The truth of the matter is they're both wrong. If you're modern orthodox, you have to work harder. You have to be 100% modern and 100% orthodox at the same time. That means if everyone finishes school at 1 o'clock because they're just modern, if you're modern orthodox, you have to finish school at 6 o'clock. A parent's dream. 6 o'clock in the evening, you have to finish school because you have to do both at the same time. And therefore, I believe that as religious Jews, we sometimes have this tendency that when it comes to global issues, issues that have to do with the wider society, we tag along. I'm saying we shouldn't tag along. We should be at the forefront. And allow me to end with the following Mishnah. The Mishnah in Avot says that every single human being was created in God's image, called the Tzelem Elohim. But the Jewish people were given an additional praise by God called Banim Lamakom, we're children of God. We don't just have a divine image of God, we're children of God. So I always like to say that if we're the children of God, we're the older children. And if we're the older children have to help their parents raise the younger children. And therefore, we as the older children have to help society raise the younger children. And our job as religious Jews is to be at the forefront of these issues and not in the back. Because we have two obligations, both as members of society and as religious Jews. Now, albeit, I don't want you to think that I'm saying that therefore, the only thing we should be concerned with this evening is what's colloquially called Tikkun Olam. You know what Tikkun Olam means? Fix the world. We shouldn't be concerned about Shabbos and kashrut, kosher food. We shouldn't be concerned about making a bracha before we eat. We shouldn't be concerned about tefillah. We should be concerned about fixing the world. That's it. God forbid, I'm not saying that, I never will say that. I'm saying when it comes to issues of Tikkun Olam, then the Jews that care about Shabbos and Kashrut and Brachot before they eat should be at the forefront and say, absolutely we're here. Absolutely we're going to be there. And we're going to be at the forefront, at the front lines doing it. Because we not only have a general obligation as part of society, we have a Jewish obligation. So it's my hope and prayer that indeed, if there's a problem of global warming out there, we Jews will be at the forefront of fighting it, not just because we're members of society, but because we really care about Judaism. Thank you all very much.